Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, what's going on? How you living? You know what? Let me answer that for you. Not nearly as well as I am, because I'm in a new shack. The paint literally is not even dry in this palace, and we just delivered a hell of a show thanks to some incredible work by my crew and a bunch of amazing people who got us out of our old place and into our new one without missing a single beat. Just when you thought this Giants season could not get any worse, future Hall of Famer Eli Manning just got shoved aside for, wait for it, Geno Smith. Ralph Facchiano came in to break that whole thing down. And LeBron James got the ejector seat from his first ever NBA game. And if that weren't enough, Xavier head coach Chris Mack came in as our first ever guest in our new studio. UFC boss Dana White broke down UFC 218, the future of Conor and Ronda, and then he took a bat to Oscar De La Hoya. Another epic appearance by Dana. Alvy, with all of that new real estate, can you imagine that this thing could get any better? So do what you do for the first time in our new studio, Alvy. Let it rip. Of all the things that I thought that I'd be talking about on a Wednesday in late November, this is the very last thing. The New York Giants announced that they have benched Eli Manning. Wait, what? Even saying that out loud does not make sense. It's been several hours since the announcement was made, and I still can't wrap my head around this. Forget for a moment that while the guy's not having a great year, he's not having a terrible year either. And that his leading receivers the last two games were Roger Lewis and Tavares King. And that he's only 36. And that he's on a decent contract for a franchise quarterback. And he's a two-time Super Bowl MVP. And the guy did start 210 straight games. Despite all of that, the Giants could not have butchered this any worse than they did. And as you can imagine, Eli was pretty busted up about this yesterday.
How hard is this hitting you emotionally?
It's hard. It's been a hard day to handle this, but hang in there and figure it out.
Hardest day as a Giant, you would say?
It's up there, yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel like you might have started your last game for the Giants?
I don't know. I don't know. I'll take one week at a time.
Last one, guys.
Have you spoken to anyone besides Ben about the decision, Jerry or John or anyone like that?
I spoke with Jerry Reese a little bit, and Mr. Mara had, you know, he hadn't been in today, and but you know, he knows what's going on, and we'll probably try to speak with him tomorrow sometime.
Right there, you can see how much this means to him. You can see how much that hurt him. And that's the other side. As far as we know, he's not physically hurt. So it's not like they're taking him aside and saying, Eli, you need to sit because you're injured. But if you're going to do something like this, if you're going to rip the heart out of the franchise, you better have a good reason. And you better have a good plan going forward. So over to you, Ben McAdoo. Exactly what is the plan going forward?
It's part of the evaluation process. Geno's come in. He's done everything that we've asked him to do. Won the backup job, and want to throw him out there and see how he performs. We feel we can put a good plan together and put him in position to help us win this ball game.
It's Ben McAdoo. He also added, quote, Geno will start this week. Over the last five games, we will take a look at Geno, and we will also give Davis an opportunity, end quote. I mean, what? You're sitting Eli Manning so you can get a look at Geno Smith. The same Geno Smith who the Jets kicked to the curb. The same Geno Smith who threw 34 picks in 30 games. You just benched a guy with 210 straight starts for a guy who missed a team meeting in San Diego because he, quote, messed up the time zones. Look, Eli has not been the problem for the Giants this year. Far from it. Maybe you can sell me on benching Eli if you want to see Davis Webb. But if you want to see Davis Webb, then see Davis Webb. Don't see Geno Smith. We've all seen plenty of Geno Smith, especially DBs. And even if this is about seeing Davis Webb, even if you end up with a top five draft pick, are you not going to take Josh Rosen, Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, or Baker Mayfield because you loved what you saw from Davis Webb throwing to Tavares King? I mean, come on. If a would-be Hall of Famer like Manning had no chance of winning, throwing it to King, and playing behind that garbage offensive line, what chance is a guy like Webb going to have?
Garbage!
And that's before we get into the idea that Eli actually pushed for McAdoo to get that job. And now McAdoo does him dirty like this. I mean, seriously. But then again, maybe it's not on McAdoo. Maybe it goes higher than him. I could say this was the most hideous decision since McAdoo went to the barber, but I won't. Because again, this is not about personal appearance. Alvin, you'll have no need in this new studio for your fat alarm. Keep that thing in check. This is bigger than that. It's even bigger than his clownishly oversized windbreakers. Oh, and speaking of that streak, this is what Eli had to say when asked about the streak and what the team actually proposed to him.
You go out there knowing you're coming out. That's, you know, I just didn't think that's, how do you prepare? Hey, you're gonna, you know, start this week. I was going to play the first half and Gino was going to start the second half. But where, you know, eventually they're going to start working in Davis and, you know, what, you know, I thought I was just starting and playing to keep a streak alive. And I didn't think that's the right thing.
I mean, tell me that's not true. Tell me that McAdoo and the team did not offer him the chance to play the first half of games just so he could keep that streak alive. That's even more insulting than benching the guy. Of course they offered him that opportunity because they knew he'd never take it. Because unlike the front office, this guy's got class and he's got a clue. And Jerry Reese and Ben McAdoo have neither. And as you might imagine, this whole thing did not go down especially well with former Giant legends on social media. Brandon Jacobs, quote, "Are you bleeping kidding me? Show me a guy with more heart and guts than Eli, and I will call you a long tongue liar," end quote. Former Giants great Carl Banks, quote, "I am very emotional about this Eli bleep. The guy who gave you everything, for better or worse, never missing a game, and this is how it ends. Not number 10. He deserves better. He gave his all when better wasn't there for him, and this is how it ends. I heard for him," end quote. Justin Tuck, quote, "I'm honestly at a loss for words. As a person that has seen Eli the QB, but also Eli the man, I'm truly pissed about what has taken place today. This decision is one of the stupidest I've seen in my time being associated with pro sports. Hashtag no loyalty. Hashtag 14 years. Hashtag bull bleep." Once again, I'm not sure if it's a Ben McAdoo call, a GM Jerry Reese call, or if it comes from higher up than that. But is any of this really worth having Justin Tuck bashing his own organization? I mean, you better be damn sure that Geno Smith or Davis Webb is about to be a Hall of Famer if you're going to do your own Hall of Famer like this and risk all the blowback that comes along with it. And it's not just the Giants. Steve Smith Sr. weighed in. He said, quote, "Wow. So Eli Manning got benched. Is it me or is Ben McAdoo running out of people to throw under the bus? He's like a student who didn't study for a test but keeps saying the teacher just doesn't like me. No, son, you failed yourself. Straight donkey." Hashtag facts. Hey, listen, I've been talking about this now for nearly an entire segment. I still can't make sense of it. I don't get anything about this. It is so un-Giant. This is an organization known for getting everything right, and they could not have gotten this any more wrong. Manning has been nothing but class since arriving in New York, through the good times and the bad. He's always repped that franchise with class and dignity, and what's he have to show for it now? An axe in his back. They just jammed this guy hard. They just jammed this guy like he's Chad Henne or something. This guy deserves so much better. We are joined by Xavier head coach Chris Mack. Chris, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Really good to visit with you. Chris, thanks so much. Let me start by asking you about Baylor. They come at you with a lot of size, but you got out to an early lead. They fought their way back into it. You pulled away once again. You've had a lot of great wins in your time at Xavier, but where does that one rank in terms of special early season wins?
Well, you have a short-term memory as a coach, so it felt good last night. We haven't been able to get Baylor in the three previous times we've played them. You know, Coach Drew does an amazing job. They have such size. I mean, I don't know if you've never seen Baylor in person. The size they present, literally in their entire front court, is all inspiring to say the least. But our guys did a really good job of getting good shots against their zone, and they played us a lot more man than I think that they typically do. And you know, credit to our kids that when Baylor fought back, like good teams do, and made it a really close game, that we were able to pull away and make some toughness plays down the stretch. But really good win for our program, for sure.
Chris Mack joining us. You know, they've got that amazing size, but one of the things that you and your players were talking about before that game and even after the game was the defensive intensity. Baylor has an explosive offense. You held them to just 15 points below their season average. So how pleased were you with the way your guys showed up on defense?
Really pleased. You know, you're going to have some lulls on offense, especially against a really good defensive team like Baylor, where maybe three or four possessions in a row are empty and you don't score and can't break your will on the defensive end. And, you know, I thought Quentin Gooden for us, Jim, did an unbelievable job of chasing their point guard, Manu Lacombe, all over the floor. You know, Baylor has so many set plays and they run a lot of staggered screens to try to get him free for open looks. And Quentin was really locked in, as were the rest of our guys, in making sure that we took away Baylor's strengths.
We're talking to Chris Mack, head coach at Xavier. You know, last night's win also gives you wins over Wisconsin on the road and Baylor at home, both of which came by double digits. So how valuable then are these early season non-conference tests in helping your team grow?
Well, I think it's really valuable. We get into league play, we're going to play in some tough environments against some really good teams. You know, a year ago, our league got 7 of the 10 Big East teams in the NCAA tournament. So we know that if we don't test ourselves now, if we don't go against good competition both at home and on the road, that we're not going to be as prepared as we need to be when we enter league play. And you know, we have some heavyweights we got to be ready for. And I think games like last night really help us do that.
Chris Mack joining us. One of the heavyweights, of course, Cincinnati on Saturday. In fact, I had Arizona Cardinals linebacker Carlos Dansby on the show yesterday. He's an Auburn alum. We were talking about the Auburn-Alabama rivalry. He said the intensity is something you simply cannot explain. So how would you describe the rivalry with Cincinnati?
Well, it's electric. You know, I think if you ask anybody that's from the city, you know, they're generally on one side or the other. You know, they either hate UC and love Xavier or hate Xavier and love UC. And, you know, it's unique. You know, the schools are 2.5 miles apart, but completely different in the terms of their identity, what the campus looks like. You know, we've had historically, both of our programs have been really good. Mick Cronin's done an unbelievable job. They've been a top 25 team, you know, the last 5 or 6 years running. He took it over, you know, when they were really down the dumps and there was a huge transition that he's made. And so their program has an identity, and I think we do as well. It's going to be an unbelievable game for our city. I think nationally people tune in. And so, yeah, a lot of respect on both sides, but also a lot of healthy hatred between the fan base. And so it's going to be interesting on Saturday.
Chris Mack joining us. So when you look at Mick Cronin's Cincinnati team and you start to get ready for them, what concerns you the most?
Well, there are a lot of things. You know, I think his teams have always been really, really good defensively. And this year's team's no different. But, you know, where they really have changed, I think, is offensively. They have a lot of answers, both in the post and on the perimeter. And, you know, for us, it starts on the glass. You know, they're an unbelievable rebounding team on both ends of the floor. It was our undoing last year. We played them really well at their place. Trayvon Blewett exploded for 40 points, but At the very end of the day, we couldn't get a defensive rebound, and that's what sealed our fate. So it's going to start on the glass, and we have to do a great job of keeping those guys off of the offensive backboard.
Chris Mack joining us. You know, mentioned Trayvon Blewett. In terms of him, he was dealing with some back pain last night, but he kept on battling. What did he show you and his teammates in continuing to fight the way he did last night?
Well, he showed me something that I already knew, Jim, and that is winning is really important to Trey. You know, he won high school state championships. He's used to winning here. And, you know, I think special players and players that are about your program, when things aren't going well for them personally during the course of the game, Trey missed a few shots that are usually layups for him, you know, some wide open threes in the first half. But he kept on battling. You know, his effort on the offensive glass in the last 3 or 4 minutes, you know, really saved the game in terms of being a 6 to 8 point game rather than a one possession game. And, you know, that's the type of play that you expect out of seniors and guys that are used to winning.
You know, Chris, last year he could have entered the NBA draft after the season, but he decided to return because, as he said, quote, "I'm not done yet." He's always been able to score the ball, but how much has his approach to the game and to practice evolved since he first arrived on campus?
Well, I think a lot of things have evolved. You know, I think number one, his body has. I mean, if you went back and watched videotape of Trey as a freshman, he'd be hardly recognizable as to what he looks like as a senior. You know, he's become like most seniors do, very mature, extremely disciplined about what he eats. He's a guy that I think gets it on both ends of the floor now. You know, if he doesn't get a shot in the first 5-6 minutes, he's not going to force a bad one. He's going to do what the game tells him to do. And from that standpoint, you feel great as a coach because he's all about winning. So I think there's been a lot of things involved, probably nothing as drastic as his body. But, you know, I think on the defensive end, he's always been a guy willing to sacrifice his body and rebound the ball. And so for us to have a guy in his final year be your best player and care that much about winning really helps our program.
We're talking to Chris Mack for a few more moments. You know, last season, I guess, is in the past. We know that. But at the same time, the past can inform the future. So when you look back on last season and how things were going at the end of the regular season and then the way you turned it around in the tournament with that great run to the Elite Eight, what kind of thoughts or memories stick out the most?
Well, I think hopefully for me, our players learn the fine line between winning and losing. You know, it's not when you win, hey, you do everything right, and it's just it's so much easier. And when you lose, you do nothing right. It's a couple plays here and there. It's a missed blockout. It's not concentrating on a free throw. It's not paying attention to the scouting report. That can really be the difference between winning and losing. And our group lost 6 games in a row, and you know, they were able to not have their confidence shook so much to the point where they snapped against each other. You know, there was no inner fighting. I think there was a belief that still permeated through our team that we could be a really good team. And then, so for me, the reward of seeing our guys being able to celebrate with their teammates and achieve something when a lot of people thought we were done was really rewarding for me to sort of see that. And I think hopefully those guys learned a year ago that just because people are predicting us to be good and just because we've had a couple good wins here early in the season doesn't mean that, you know, Saturday is going to automatically happen. You know, we have to make that happen and understand the difference between winning and losing is a fine line.
Such a great matchup coming up on Saturday. Before I let you go, the really important stuff too. Now, Chris, like Halloween candy.
Of course.
The Halloween candy. You tweeted out a pic of your son Braden's Halloween candy arranged from best to worst with Kit Kat on one end and what appeared to be Laffy Taffy on the other. You got to break that down for me.
Well, I'm going to tell you, anytime you get any type of taffy, I mean, come on, it's 2017. You know, like the honeybee things, those little black wrapper pieces of candy. Nobody's eating those. You know, nobody's eating those.
Right.
And then, you know, I'm a Kit Kat guy, but hey, there were some really good things. You know, fortunately, we live on a nice street. You know, some of my son's candy, those were the real size candy bars. And as you know, when you get one of those on Halloween night, that's a home run.
Well, that is a home run. All right, so if that's the way you feel about that, and Kit Kat's on one end, where, for instance, do you come out on Starburst as a candy?
See, I'm not a big Starburst fan.
Yeah,
you know,
me neither.
I think it should be more chocolates, caramels, you know, on Halloween then it should be, you know, Starburst. They stick to your teeth. I think they're nasty. I put those more at the bottom end of the spectrum.
Preach. Preach, Chris. I was going to say the exact same thing. In fact, if you had said to me, where do you come out on Starburst, I would have answered it the exact same way. I'm more of a chocolate guy. I don't get it. So let me ask you this. What is worse to hand out on Halloween, candy corn or pennies?
Man, I'll tell you, you got to be a miser if you're handing out pennies on Halloween. You know, like, if you can't make the effort to go to your local Kmart or King Quick or something to get some candy and pass out to the kids, it's a problem. But, you know, now Walmart and some of these stores make it so easy. I mean, all you have to do is go out and spend $10. But to pass out pennies or popcorn balls or, you know, some gifts, you know, gift certificates for like 50 cents, I mean, you got to step up your game a little bit, I believe.
You got to step your game up, right, Alvy? Step your game up.
Step your game
Don't
up.
Don't be a miser. Don't give out pennies. Hey, Chris, last
sort of
thought.
Like you guys have stepped up your game.
You
in
have
the
to.
Studio.
You have to, right? And you got a new studio. You got to step your game up. You know that, Chris. You have to. You're closing in on Pete Gillen's school record of 202 wins as a head coach. I know you're not in it for records like that, but it's a really big number. What does that mean to you?
It means I've been here a long time, and I'm very appreciative of it. I think that you know, coaches are defined by their players, guys that listen, that want to win. And I've been able to coach some unbelievable players, some guys that are all about winning. And I'm really fortunate. And I don't look at it as my anything. You know, this is our team, our program, and just very fortunate to be a representative of Xavier.
November 28th. Is a day that I think we're all going to remember. It's a day that's going to live on in sports history. And not only because it was the day that the Giants announced that Eli Manning's starting streak would end, but also it's the day that LeBron's ejection streak ended. Eli will not be starting an NFL game for the first time since 2004. And last night, LeBron was ejected from an NBA game for the first time since, well, ever. The Cavs were blowing out the Heat. LeBron was in the middle of a double-double. So let's skip to 1:59 remaining in the third quarter.
LeBron now the other way. Takes it to the top of the key. Hesitates down the left alley. Drew contact. Oh, my goodness. Nothing called. LeBron is going to get a technical. Did. Now he got thrown out. Wow, he got a double technical. Kane Fitzgerald just threw LeBron out of the game with 1:59 remaining in the third quarter. LeBron went right at Fitzgerald. I'm not sure I've ever seen that. I mean, LeBron didn't make contact. He went at him. I mean, certainly he deserved one technical.
Oh, my goodness.
But he was just given a double technical for basically one exchange. I mean, he went right at Kane Fitzgerald, made a gesture at him. He did throw his arm at him. I mean, there was a ton of contact. But, I mean, a double technical and LeBron's gone.
That's Cavs Radio. So let the record book show that it was Kane Fitzgerald who administered LeBron's first ejection. And again, if we know Kane Fitzgerald's name, that's not a good thing. If you know the name of any referee, it's generally not a good thing. So Kane Fitzgerald is the one who administers LeBron's first ever NBA ejection. And it was pretty shocking. Because again, like the announcer said, it's not like he flew off into some rage. It's not like he made contact with an official. Other than giving off a, you know who the hell I am, vibe, he really didn't seem to do much of anything at all. Except there's a T, here's another, now you're gone, thanks for coming. The first ejection ever for LeBron, and it happened in the middle of a 23-point blowout. I mean, weird. Really weird. Now, of course, there are always two sides to every single story, and LeBron's side is, after he got a steal, he went up the court, and he was fouled as he missed that layup.
You know, that particular play, I got fouled all the way up the court, you know, from the time that I stripped him all the way till I got to the rim. And, you know, so that's what it was about. And I said what I had to say, and I moved on, but he decided I should get two of them, you know. So it is what it is. We got the win, and that's what's most important.
Nothing more tired than stars crying about calls they don't get and then saying it is what it is. Except LeBron's got a point. He does have a point. While he took 11 shots in the paint last night, he only went to the line once, and that was 30 seconds into the game. And there's no way you can tell me that on the other 10 shots in the paint that nobody in a Heat jersey made contact with him. It's just not physically possible. And he is averaging a career low free throws despite doing the bulk of his work in the lane, so I understand his frustration. But there are two sides to every story. As for the ref, Fitzgerald's story is, quote, "It was a culmination of a couple of different acts. Immediately after the no call, he turned and he threw an air punch directly at me. Then he aggressively charged at me. Then he used vulgarity in my ear a few times." End of quote. So what it is a case of he said, he said. Now, wait a minute. It's not just a case of that. Because now we've got a third dude in. And that third man in is Enes Kanter. No, the Knicks had absolutely nothing to do with last night's Cavs Heat game, but that didn't stop Kanter from sprinting into the cage and getting in on the fight. He jumped on Twitter with a pic of LeBron and the ref. He circled the ref and had the caption, "King of Cleveland, hashtag his favorite playground, hashtag strive for greatness."
Strive for greatness out here, cuz.
I mean, that's classic Kanter. That's a guy who's just itching for a reason to go, either in person or online. And he did, dropping a strong callback to LeBron's Instagram post after Cleveland's comeback win at the Garden a few weeks back. So what about LeBron? What's he going to do with that? LeBron's reaction to Kanter's tweet was a shrug and a remark that Kanter's, quote, "always looking for attention." Yeah, that and LeBron's smart enough not to give it to him. He's not getting hooked by a guy who is of no threat to him and means nothing to him, no matter how funny the guy is. And this is part of the problem, right? Kanter is going to have to start winning some of these matchups on the court, or else LeBron's going to keep doing that. He's going to keep shrugging the whole thing off. It's not a good rivalry until the Knicks were actually in the same league as the Cavs, and then it'll be great. Don't get me wrong. I love the hustle from Cantor to go right to his phone and get online with that blast as quickly as he possibly could, especially considering who he's taking a shot at. I love that. I just hate the fact that they're not going to face each other on the court until April 8th. That part's terrible. I need these guys to play tonight, and then tomorrow, and then the night after that, and the night after that. So if they can't, I guess we just need Cantor to keep tweeting and chirping LeBron nonstop until April. And knowing this guy, he probably will. Ralph Vacchiano is my guest. Ralph, really nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Ralph, I'm great. Great to visit with you. Thanks for making time. Let me ask you, you were there for day one of the Geno Smith era. How would you describe the vibe around the Giants facility today?
Well, you know, it seems a little down. I think everybody's quiet and cautious. You know, anytime you make a switch like this, especially a high-profile one, no one really knows how to act because, you know, it's not Geno Smith's fault. So his teammates, his coaches want to be excited for him and support him, but they're all very respectful of Eli Manning and what they know he's going through right now. So, you know, I think overall it's the ending of an era. It's kind of a somber day around the building. It's not like they're, you know, when Eli first got his start, it was the excitement of things to come. This is more about the sadness of things ending.
All right, so when that went down yesterday and you first heard about that, what was your initial reaction when you heard the news that the team was going to start Geno Smith instead of Eli Manning?
I was blown away on several fronts from the fact that they've made this decision now after, you know, they maybe hinted at it at times. We've asked multiple times, are you going to play Davis Webb? You know, I think Ben McAdoo at one point said, I don't see a situation where we'll do that. It just came so suddenly. They did it with a press release. And that they turned to Geno Smith was even more mind-boggling because I can't find anybody in the Giants organization who says Geno Smith is the future quarterback here. So if you're going to do this and do this to Eli Manning, why wouldn't you just turn to Davis Webb, who might be their quarterback of the future? It's a kind of a hard part of this move to understand.
Yeah, I mean, so Ralph, so what is the answer to that question? If you want to get a look at Davis Webb, that's one thing. Why not get a look at Davis Webb? Why are they turning to Geno Smith right now instead of Webb?
Yeah, there's an answer to that question, and it's not a good one. They will turn to Davis Webb at some point. This move is absolutely about seeing Davis Webb, but the coaches don't feel like he's ready right now. They think it would be kind of unfair to throw him on one week of increased reps into a game in Oakland, a difficult place to play. So they want Geno Smith to at least get this week, maybe even next week, or at least part of it, to give Davis Webb some time to work his way up. Of course, the follow-up question to that is, if Davis Webb isn't ready, why not let Eli Manning just start for the next week or so? And then, why isn't Davis Webb ready? This is not a surprise that the Giants season is basically over. Why didn't a month ago the coaches start to say, you know what, let's start giving Davis Webb some increased practice time just in case. Those questions haven't been answered yet.
Ralph, you're good. You asked my three follow-up questions for me. I like that. Nice job. Ralph Vacchiano joining us. He's the author of Eli Manning, The Making of a Quarterback. It's available in paperback right now. I mean, Ralph, the team has suffered an incredible number of injuries, especially to the receiving core. So how much of this 2-9 record is on Eli Manning? How much of this season is Eli Manning's fault?
You know, he gets some of the blame, and I think there's a percentage of it that always has to fall on the quarterback no matter what, because, and he would admit this, he's a franchise quarterback. It's his job to make the players around him better, and, you know, I don't know that that's been the case for much of this season. On the other hand, you can't ignore the fact that the players around him are just not good. This offensive line has been a disaster for multiple seasons. Yes, a more mobile quarterback might be better behind an offensive line like this, but the Giants knew what Eli Manning was. So, you know, why they would not address that and give him more of a pocket is beyond me. You know, you take the best two receivers or three receivers really away from any quarterback and things would fall apart. They lose Odell Beckham, one of the best weapons in the league, Brandon Marshall, who was supposed to be their number two, and even Sterling Shepard, who's been a real good player for the Giants the last 2 years, hasn't played much. So, he doesn't have a lot of help. He could have done more, but it's almost unfair to even say that because this is just a bad team, especially when the injuries started to hit.
You know, when you look back at some of the things that Ben McAdoo has said about Eli over the past year, should we not have all seen this coming? And then how would you describe the relationship between McAdoo and Manning?
Well, there's no question we should have seen this coming. And I think to an extent we probably did. We've had a lot of stories and a lot of talk in New York about, you know, is there a fractured relationship between the two? Ben McAdoo always insisted no. Eli Manning always insisted no. But, you know, Ben McAdoo has been very critical. And starting at the combine last year, when we asked him about the offensive line, rather than rip his offensive line or criticize them, he talked about how Eli Manning needed to be quicker on his feet and get used to playing behind a pocket that would crumble. You know, he had the famous thing where the Giants lost the game on a partially because of a delay of game penalty. Ben McAdoo blamed that sloppy quarterback play. He's taken shots at Eli mildly before, but what's notable is he rarely takes shots at other players. So clearly, he had been hinting all along that maybe he wanted a more mobile quarterback. Maybe he'd be looking in a different direction. And people around Eli Manning always kind of hinted that maybe the relationship wasn't great. But Ben McAdoo and Eli Manning always insisted, and even still insist, that that wasn't the case. It's just the evidence certainly supports that maybe they weren't always on the same page.
Ralph Facciano joining us for a few more moments. I mean, you could see how busted up Eli was when he discussed it yesterday. You've known him since 2004. You have covered him for everything. In fact, you literally wrote the book on him, Eli Manning, The Making of a Quarterback. So what do you make of how he's handled all of this?
Typical class. Really, the fact that he showed some emotion yesterday, it's always surprising. The only other two times I can remember that happening were, Tom Coughlin's farewell press conference, and there was a game his rookie year where he was benched in the third or fourth start against the Baltimore Ravens. He was a disaster. He nearly broke down talking about how he let his teammates down. Other than that, you rarely see any kind of human emotion side of Eli like that. I think he let his guard down a little bit. But he's, from what everybody around him tells me, he's blown away by this. He's not happy about it. He thinks it could have been handled better. But you watch his press conference, you would never get that even hint from him. He just handles it with class. He takes it in stride. And quite honestly, from everything I've heard from people in the building today, he was back at work this morning focusing on helping Davis Webb and Geno Smith get ready. And I got to tell you, I don't know that I would have handled it as well as he did, because I'd be pretty angry right now.
So, Ralph, where do you think that leaves him? I mean, on the one hand, he's always said that he wanted to play his entire career with one team, especially that team. And then on the other hand, he's got nothing to prove, right? But maybe he does now after all this. So if you had to guess, has he played his last game with the Giants? And if he has, where do you think he might end up? Would he keep playing or maybe just retire?
I don't get the sense at all that he wants to retire. He's said before he wants to keep playing, especially because he's healthy. Everybody I know around him says he wants to keep playing. He obviously would prefer to play with the Giants, but I don't think he has any interest in coming back and having to fight for his job or just being a backup and a mentor to Davis Webb or somebody they might draft. I think in the offseason, he's going to explore his options, whether that's asking the Giants to release him or waiving his no-trade clause. Everything's a little raw right now, and nobody really knows what he's going to do, but I think most people who know him suspect that that will be the case. And people that know him also know he understands the realities of the NFL. There are a couple of teams who you could make an argument would be a contender, a real contender with better quarterback play. He knows the Denver Broncos, where his brother played out his career, are in that situation. He absolutely knows Tom Coughlin's Jacksonville Jaguars are in that situation. So if he can engineer an opportunity to go there rather than just stand on the sidelines with the Giants, I think he'd be willing to do that. I think he feels like he has two or three good years left.
All right, so finally, where does that leave Ben McAdoo for next year and even GM Jerry Reese?
Well, the assumption all along had been that they're going to both be out of a job. I can't imagine the Giants' season is going to get better with Geno Smith or Davis Webb running the show. So, you're still looking at a two- or three-win type of season, and it's going to be hard for John Mara to stand up at the end of the season and say, this was a disaster, but I'm bringing everybody back. So I do think both of them will be out of a job. It's going to be an interesting question, though, for John Mara and Steve Tisch. You just let two guys make this monumental decision for this franchise and about the future of the franchise, even though they may not be part of the future, which is one of the great unanswered questions here. But, it's hard right now to see any way that Reese or McAdoo will be back with this team next season.
So quick follow-up then. If they don't come back and they bring in a coach that for some reason really likes Eli Manning, is there any way this thing could swing back and Manning might be open to staying for the right coach?
Oh, absolutely. I think Manning's ideal situation would be to stay. I don't know that after this he necessarily wants to play for Ben McAdoo. There might be some friction there. But if a new coach comes in and says to him, you're my guy, I think this would be Eli Manning's number one choice. I think he would even like the idea of a redemption story to try to win back the fans and everybody with a winning season. I just think he won't come back or won't want to come back if the circumstance is you're our backup or you've got to go battle for this job. He's going to have to be told you're the man.
Dana White joins us again for a few moments. Dana, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm great, buddy. How you doing?
Good, good. Dana, good to visit. You've got Saturday's card, which features a rematch of Max Holloway and Jose Aldo. Dana, there was a time when Aldo was the baddest man on the planet. He was unbeatable, but he's lost two of his last three fights. Conor McGregor got him in Holloway. How badly do you think Aldo wants to get back the belt that he once had?
Yeah, no, I think he wants it bad. He seems very hungry. He jumped up and took this opportunity when Frankie Edgar got hurt. And in no way, shape, or form am I making excuses for Jose Aldo, but in his last fight with Holloway, his leg was messed up, so he couldn't throw the leg kicks the way that he wanted to, which is basically his bread and butter. So it's going to be I'm real curious to see how he what kind of a game plan he has going into this one.
You know, Dan, interesting you said that because that's exactly what Aldo and his camp were saying, that I wasn't right. Holloway heard that, and he wasn't buying it. Holloway said, quote, hopefully he doesn't have an injury this time, and hopefully he kicks more. Kicks don't. The guy was dead tired in the second round. There's a feeling in there when a guy is falling off. His mouth was open. I was able to taunt him. I stalked and slapped him, and from that time on, I knew this guy's not moving anymore. Bottom line, Dana, for those who don't know Holloway, like, what's this guy's deal? How would you describe him as a fighter and as a person?
Yeah, no, I love that. And that's the beauty of, you know, when you have a legend like Jose Aldo and he goes in and he has that, hey, my leg was messed up. Well, guess what? We're going to do it again and we're going to see, you know, we're going to see where this thing ends up. That's what I love about this fight, you know. You know, it's funny because we had the Frankie Edgar fight, which was great. But the Jose Aldo fight being in there now is incredible. We're very lucky that we're this deep in the roster and that Jose wanted this fight because I love this fight. I love Max Holloway. Like you said, this guy is a real fighter. He's a gangster. He will slap you. He will try to run him down and finish him the way he did the first time.
UFC.
Can he do it? Can Aldo stop it? It's a perfect fight.
Excuse me, Dana. 2FC or UFC 218 is Saturday night in Detroit. It's live on pay-per-view. Dana, one more thought about Aldo. I mean, we're talking about a fighter who was unbeatable, but now he's lost two of his last three fights. When something like that happens, what does that do to a guy's mystique, aura, and his own confidence?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. But he lost to Conor McGregor. You know what I mean? One of those losses is to Conor McGregor. And people can say whatever they want about Conor. Conor went in and looked damn good against Floyd Mayweather for the first four rounds. You know what I mean? So to lose to Conor is one thing. But, yes, his second loss and Max Holloway, you know, the only guy who's beat Max Holloway in 4 years is Conor McGregor. So two really tough guys for Aldo.
You know, Dana, when you mentioned Conor, when you and I spoke a while back, we talked about the possibility of Conor fighting before the end of the year, and you've now announced the UFC 219 card in Las Vegas on December 30th. Conor is not a part of that. Is that in any way, Dana, connected to what went down when he jumped into the cage at a Bellator fight earlier this month?
Yeah, you know, obviously that, and, you know, he was, you know, he's a little rambunctious at our event, too, out in Poland. So he's been a little, you know, you've been in this game for a long time, Rome. You know, you see these guys, they're young, they become super famous, and, you know, you get $100 million in the bank. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's hard to keep guys on the tracks, you know. It's one of those things I question daily, you know. When I talk to Conor, you know, Conor still has that fire, I want to do this, I want to do that. Yet at the same time, he's all over the place. You know, there's a level of uncertainty in any business. Like I said, when we sold the company, I had lawyers and, you know, a matchmaker and other guys who made a lot of money and decided to never work again, you know. So who knows?
Dana, the point you're trying to make is actually very well taken. You've got matchmakers and lawyers who don't want to work. They don't get up in the morning and get punched in the face for a living.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's tough. So hopefully, I'm hoping that Conor is going to blow off some steam, have some fun with his money, and then want to come back and fight again.
Dana White joining us. Yeah,
we'll see how this thing plays out.
You know, Dana, you said yesterday also that you do not want to see Ronda Rousey fight again. What do you mean by that, and what have you seen from her that makes you feel that way?
Well, the thing is about Rhonda is if you look at her life, right, ever since she was a little girl, she started training in judo, then went after two Olympic runs, ended up medaling. Then as soon as she was done with that, she started focusing on mixed martial arts and then wanted to, you know, started fighting and training and wanted to become a world champion. Became a world champion, defended her title 6 times, you know, created this entire women's thing that's going on here in the UFC. And now she's in her early 30s. She's basically had no personal life her whole life. And now she has one. She just got married. She's incredibly happy. And she's, like, ready to move on to that next chapter of her life. What more does she have to prove here in the UFC? First of all, another one that has millions and millions of dollars, has enough money that she never needs to work again, and has just moved on to that next chapter. I'm happy for her. I care about her. She's my friend. And I just don't think she has anything else to prove here.
UFC 218, Holloway v. Aldo 2, Saturday in Detroit, live on pay-per-view. Dana, one last thought. I was just thinking, remember when Oscar De La Hoya just went crazy on Mayweather-McGregor? I mean, he hated that. He hated that idea. Thought it was like the worst thing ever for boxing. But now he says he's willing to fight McGregor. What do you make of that?
The nuttiest whack job on earth. This guy, I don't know if this guy is hitting the yayo and the booze again or what his deal is, but this guy is on another planet. I have zero respect for this guy. First of all, like you said, Mayweather versus McGregor was a complete disrespect to the sport of boxing. It was disgusting. He was F you and all the stuff on Twitter like a complete nut. But him versus Conor McGregor is a good idea. This guy is a complete nut.
Yo, Fabian, what's up?
What's going on, Romy? Hey, I'm going to be late punching my clock. That's the only I know I could talk all day. You let me. I'm cool like that. Hey, Romy, I just want to congratulate you, and I have to get back to work. And, I mean, I was going to talk Rams, you know, whatever, but I got to go, my man. Sorry. Bye.
Fabian, what the hell did you call for then? What was that? I could talk all day, but I have to go. Which one is it? You can talk all day or you have to go. Neep. All right, let's do this. Fabian, you should get yourself together and you should call me back. Listen, man, just take a deep breath. Hit the reset button, reboot, think about it. Your calls sound pretty similar, so I know you could do this. I know you could do this. Fabian, bro, listen, I don't want to come down too hard on you because you have so much history with this show, but did you see what I just did? I said that for a certain caller, I will go right to the call. I'll skip my rant. I'll skip what I was going to do. All right, so I totally break format, and I make an allowance for you. And then what do? You start off by saying, hey, Rome, I could talk all day. I'm like, good. There's a reason for me to skip what I was going to do to go to you. But then you immediately say, yeah, I got to go, Rome. Sorry about that. So I dropped what I was doing, and I broke my format to go to you, but you don't want to call, or you don't want to talk. If you don't have time to talk, why did you call? Fabian, I'm very confused, even more so than when you call. My man, call me back. In fact, I will keep a line open for you. Call me back and let's do it again, but this time let's do it the right way. Only for you, Fabian, because you did me wrong. If I'm going to break a format or break the format for you to take your call, do not say, oh, I don't have time to talk. Bye, Rome. Oh, there he is. Good. Fabian, let's pretend that that did not happen and let's do it again. We start hour number 3. I'm going to break my format and I'll do it for certain people like this guy, Fabian in LA. Fabian, brother, what's going on?
Doggy dog. I swear, Rome, it's the most... Oh, man. Okay.
I tried. Yeah, I'm not going to make the same mistake 3 times, all right? Whatever, dog. Doggy dog. Next time. And that's it. Day 1 in our new house, and man, it felt awesome. Check out episode 15 of the Jim Rome podcast. Houston Rockets GM Daryl Morey was my guest. Executive producer Adam Hawk also made a cameo. One of those guys might be a genius. The other of those guys is Adam Hawk. Thanks again, clones. Appreciate you very much. Check back tomorrow. I am out.